legendary talent began his career as the founder of the group Lighthouse before joining Saturday Night Live as their first musical director between 1975 and 1980. He soon fell into a collaboration with director David Cronenberg, a relationship that still thrives after 12 films together. His uniquely expressive and unforgettable work can be heard in films as diverse as The Fly, Ed Wood, Silence of the Lambs, The Departed, Mrs. Doubtfire, and of course, Peter Jackson's epic Lord of the Rings trilogy, which is a remarkable work, breathtaking both in its scope and pure emotional power. His work is beloved by fans across the globe, and critics, groups, and awards organizations agree. His long list of honors include 11 ASCAP Awards, 2 Saturn Awards, 3 Golden Globes, 4 Grammys, a Career Achievement Award from the National Board of Review, and 3 Oscars for his work on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And this amazingly talented musician doesn't slow down for a second. His new score for David Cronenberg's latest film, Eastern Promises, is in stores now. The Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra will be performing his Lord of the Rings symphony this coming weekend, and the complete recordings of his score for Return of the King will be released on November 6th. It is a tremendous honor to welcome to our show Mr. Howard Shore. Let me see if I can bring this line up. Mr. Shore, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Shore, thank you so much for joining us tonight and taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to start, when did you know that music would be your life?
I started studying quite young, when I was 8 and 9, and I was studying harmony and counterpoint, and started to play music with other musicians. And then I met other writers, mm-hmm. and friends of mine who then became directors, and some became actors. And that group as a kid, in the teens, was really important to me because some of those friendships were very long-lasting. And I did a little directing. I did some acting, and then I just decided around 17 to pursue music, and music was the thing I was really interested in.
So you started bands. You started Lighthouse.
Bands when I was 14, right? 13, 14. Lighthouse started, I think, about 1969, and I was one of the founding members of that group, and I toured with the group for 4 years. I did, I think, about 1,000 one-nighters between 69 and 72, and I was quite young, so I got to see a lot of the world, and we toured with Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Big Brother, and the Holding Company. It was an interesting period.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
So how did the job at Saturday Night Live come about for you?
Well, Lorne is a few years older than I am, but we met at a summer camp in northern Ontario when we were kids. I was 13 when I met Lauren, and we became good friends. And when we started writing together, and we did a show actually in northern Ontario in summer camp at a camp called Timberlane that was like a sketch comedy show. It was the early genesis of Saturday Night Live. This is now about 1960, 61, and we do it a show once a week at this co-ed camp on Saturday night, and that was really the start of our collaboration. And then we met Danny Aykroyd and Gilda Radner in Toronto, and Second City people, and Lorne went to California. I went on the road. He was working with Lily Tomlin and Flip Wilson, and we met in New York, back in New York at 1975, again with a group of friends, and started the show. There was probably about maybe 15 of us, 12 or 15 writers, performers, musicians, directors, that kind of thing.
Just an amazing, just a breathtaking assemble of just tremendous talents that converge for Saturday Night Live at the beginning.
It was an interesting time. I mean, people came from California, from Chicago, mostly from Second City. Belushi was from Chicago, and then Bill Murray came from Chicago. Gilda from Detroit. Danny Aykroyd was in Toronto. So, you know, so a group of us came. We came from all over. Some people were in New York. Ann Beats, Michael O'Donoghue in New York. Cheryl Hardwick was in New York.
You were also instrumental in the formation of the Blues Brothers. Is that correct?
Well, the Blues Brothers were. It was an opening act for the show. As when we did the warm up.
Mm-hmm.
On Saturday night for the dress rehearsal and for the live audience, we do a warm-up with the band. And it was very open. It was very free, and we'd do improvisations, and we'd play a lot of blues stuff and R&B stuff, stuff that I love from that period, from the Stax catalog. And I was writing R&B tunes and writing the theme to the show, which was very Junior Walker inspired, and so the blues was part of the creation of the show. I mean, it was what we were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so Danny would join in and play a little harp with us in the beginning, you know, just warming up. It was a very loose kind of thing. And then John wanted to join in and be part of it, and I would introduce them as those brothers in blues. The Blues Brothers. I don't know where it came from, but I would just introduce them as that, and then that sort of stuck, and it kind of went on from there.
Mm. What kind of tools did you take away from your SNL experience?
Well, it was a good collaborative period. It was a great way to work with writers very, very carefully, very closely. It was a good way to work with performers. You got to work with different directors. The hosts were there every week, a variety of hosts, really interesting, fascinating people from all areas of the world. They were writers, performers. So, I mean, you learned a lot. I mean, I was in my 20s. It was a way to really do repertory theater for television. It was like, you know, a group activity that expressed itself in a weekly show. You know, Saturday at 11:30 was a culmination of our work that week.
Yeah.
And the early years of the show, there really was no form to it. Now, when you watch Saturday Night Live, you know what it is, and you know when update comes, and you know it has this structure to it. But in the beginning, it was very free form, and you could, if you watch those early shows, it was us just trying to come up with enough ideas in music and comedy, you know, to really do 90 minutes of good television a week.
Yeah, it's a tremendous challenge, I'm sure. During this time, did David Cronenberg approach you? How did that relationship begin?
No, as I mentioned earlier, I've been writing and, you know, I've been studying music since I was a kid and writing, and really didn't have the means to realize the things that I was hearing in my mind. I was only able to work with, you know, small groups, chamber groups, brass trios, you know, whatever I could get together to write for. And writing for the band on the show was okay, you know, for the period. It was exciting for a year or two, but it was limited in a way to what I was wanting to do with music and the things that I was imagining. So I thought movies were very experimental to me, because I came of age kind of in the 50s and the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So movies always, film music to me was a way to really try really kind of different things. It was a way to experiment and do things. And so I kind of looked to that. And around 78, I did a film in Canada, a thriller. It's actually a murder mystery film with Elka Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then David knew about that. And then I think when he was doing The Brood in 1978, I think it was around the same period, I asked him, I approached him if he was interested in having an original score for his films, because he had always did his films with needle drop, didn't have the budget to hire a composer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cronenberg, David's been making movies since he was 16, 8mm movies. And then 16 millimeter, and then 35. So, around the time of The Brood, 78, he felt he was maybe ready to try it. And he knew me. I was younger than David, and he's a few years older than I am. I think about 3 or 4 years older. So, when you're kids, I mean, when I was 12, David was 16, and you'd see him in the neighborhood, and he had this beautiful Italian motorcycle, and he had great clothes, and he had a page boy haircut from the 60s, you know, and he just looked amazing, and you would see him around the neighborhood, and you didn't know who he was, and when you were 12, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
Sight, you know. And so, and then I found out that he made films, and I would see his films in underground film festivals, which were popular in the 60s. And you'd go at midnight, and you'd see, you know, films till like 2, 3 in the morning at these underground festivals. Mm-hmm. And most, a lot of short films, 30-minute films, one-reeler type things. And I saw some of his short films, and so I became interested in what he was doing. And around, the, and then again around the time of the Brood 78, I approached him to see if he was interested in work collaboration, and he said yes, he was, and so we started working together.
And talk about a collaboration
yeah.
that's just endured and thrived so well throughout the years. Tell me about that working relationship. What makes the two of you gel so well together?
I think just, you know, that we're from a very similar background. We both grew up in Toronto and a similar neighborhood. A lot of our friends now are people that we knew when we were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And David says I introduced him to his wife, Carolyn, that he's been married to for a long time. I don't know how long, but quite a long time. So I think there's just a like sensibility, you know, in the way we look at things, the way we look at films, the way David is the most well-read person I know. And I think his age... maybe that fact that he's a few years older than me always seems like a bit of an older brother, and I was sort of mm-hmm. looking up to him because he always knew much more than I did, and I was always learning things from him all the time. And I still feel that way. I still feel that every time he takes on a new project, there's a learning curve because you're catching up to Cronenberg. Never
yeah.
really, you know, you don't really know enough. I mean, you know, Eastern Promises is interesting because he did a, you know, like a celebrity list in Amazon of books that he had studied for the film, and mm-hmm. he listed the top 10 books that were all about, you know, Russian politics, Russian philosophy, Russian criminal activity. I mean, amazing books. And I thought, you know, it's so incredible. I mean, he's interested in so many things, and he's so well-read, so it's a constant learning. And I think that's an inspiring thing because the group has stayed together for a long time, almost 30 years making these films.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always constantly growing and, you know, we're learning new things and we're expressing new ideas. And also when you have a group like that that works together, there's no way to go back. You're constantly going forward because
yeah.
you've done all this work. And so you can't revert to something you've done. Nobody gets away with anything, you see, because everybody knows everything about everybody.
Yeah, it's like a family.
Yeah, so you've got to constantly be on your toes and be doing your best work.
So let's talk about Eastern Promises for a little bit. I'm interested in the process of crafting a musical voice for these films.
Mm-hmm.
So taking Eastern Promises, what did you have to understand about the themes of the film, or what were your considerations before you started to craft that theme?
Well, David always sends me either the books that he's interested in or books that he's adapting very early on. I mean, he sends these scripts to me really early when he's just starting to think about it, and even before he's cast the film. So you start clicking away on things that he's thinking about. I mean, Eastern Promises, it involved a lot of research of Russian folk music. We listened to a lot of music together. You know, we would do the research in the libraries, and then we would pass the music back and forth to each other. So we were constantly listening to a lot of music, and he was listening to a lot of music when he was shooting. And I always go to visit him when he's shooting. I always go to the set. I meet the actors. Of course, I know Viggo from Lord of the Rings and from History of Violence. And so it's great to see him. And, you know, and also Peter Shusitsky, the great cinematographer who shot Dead Ringers and all the movies in between, is incredible. And so Ron Sanders is there during the shoot, who has been editing David's films for years, fantastic editor. And so it's a, you know, you're going and being part of this group, Carol Spear, the production designer, and you're soaking up atmosphere from the set, from the script, from David. Watching David shoot is a really interesting experience, and really, you know, it's really thought provoking when you watch how he shoots and the things that he selects and how he, where he moves the camera and where he puts the camera. It's really interesting. And so all of those things, I think you go away from that with ideas and you start to assemble a body of work just based on the idea of the film. We also looked at Russian criminal tattoos. There's a wonderful documentary Alex Lambert did. Went into a high-security Russian prison and shot criminals with shot their tattoos, basically. And it's a documentary on what the tattoos mean, the hierarchy of the criminals in prison, and how all of their history is expressed on their body. You can tell in prison just by looking at a man's tattoos what he's done, how many murders he's done, how many felonies, how many robberies, tells you everything about him. And there's actually a scene in Eastern Promises just before the steam bath where they're coming down the hall, and he says they like to have the meetings in the steam room because you can tell, you get to see what a man looks. You can see his tattoos.
Right.
You know who you're dealing with.
Yeah. I remember reading an interview recently with Viggo Mortensen where he discussed how important those tattoos were.
Yes.
It even took 4 hours a day in makeup to put those on, but it was very important for his character.
Yeah. So we passed the documentary around. We looked at books of tattoos, tattoo art from the period. And then through the folk music, listening to the folk music, I started writing and, you know, thematic ideas all away from the film, just thinking about the film. And then I create, you know, a series of pieces based on the impressions of the film, and then there's a scoring process later on that actually is taking this music and scoring it, if you will, you know, to the film, you know, deciding where things go and how they go and how they're orchestrated, and, you know, it's a very linear process doing film music. It's a step, you know, it doesn't all happen at once. It's a, you know, there's composition, orchestration, and then recording, which is performance, really, when you're in the studio with the actual musicians, which is a whole part of the process in itself, and then the post process of editing and, you know, actually producing them.
And Cronenberg is a hands-on, has hands-on involvement. He's there with you every step of the way in the studio, or
he is in a kind of mental, intuitive way. You know, we'll talk on the phone a lot if we're not physically in the same place. But it's a constant dialogue, really.
Yeah.
And until we discover, you know, the truth of the story, discover the truth of it musically. I mean, sometimes it's difficult. It's not always easy working with people that you've worked, you know, as I say, because it's this constantly changing landscape. I remember when we were doing Spider, it was difficult to find the, you know, the idea, the music sense of Spider, because Spider didn't speak. You know, it was such an interior world, and music is a very interior world. It's a very emotional, interior, practice, really, music. So to find Spider was difficult. I mean, it took a while to find that. And I think all of these films do. They all have their, you know, their discovery, and their, you know, it takes a lot of work just to find the essence and the truth of the film.
that's what I love about Cronenberg's work is, you know, so many movies out there are carbon copies of another movie you've seen, but David Cronenberg's films, you've never seen those before. So I was discussing with Jerry, my co-host earlier in the show, you take a movie like Crash, you're seeing the movie Crash without a score, you're needing to come up with a musical voice for that film. Mm-hmm. And it's unlike anything you've ever seen before. I cannot imagine how daunting that must be.
It is, and what you do, and I talked about this in Lord of the Rings, because we talked about daunting. You said it's a daunting, and I started on that project, and you felt like Frodo. You felt like this little hobbit. You know, you had this one, and you had to take this object to Mordor, a place you didn't know how to get there, where it was, how difficult it was going to be. And you just proceed, you know, with will power and determination,
right?
And you know, discipline to do it. And you just proceed, and you just kind of go step by step. And you can't go from A to Z immediately. You have to go through the steps day by day. You know, it's kind of ritualistic in a way. And you just proceed in increments, and then suddenly you look behind you. And you have ideas and thoughts, and you know you're starting to create the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there's 5 minutes of music, and then there's 10, and then there's 30. You know, you add to it. It's a very additive kind of mental discipline, really, composition.
Well, talking about building it a little at a time, you have the complete recordings for all three films. I believe The Return of the King is released on November 6th.
Yes, we're just finishing it. Yes,
and that's something like 11 plus hours of music total, isn't it?
I think it's close. Well, it's 10 CDs in total.
Mm.
Are part of the complete recordings. Three for Fellowship, 3-2 Towers, and four for Return of the King, and it's as complete, you know, as I can do right now. I mean, without any outtakes or rarities or anything.
Right.
I mean, there's actually more music, but I mean, some of it wasn't used in the film. I mean, what I put on the complete recordings is everything that was used in the films. There's four CDs of music in Return of the King extended version, the long version.
Wow.
Oh, what a staggering accomplishment.
And so it's all been it's been remastered, it's been edited into tracks. Doug Adams' liner notes are fantastic. You know, there's 50 pages of liner notes for each edition, and then Doug is working on a standalone book next year for all of the music for the trilogy. And it's a we've been working on it. The releases it took 3 years, one year for each edition. So really, the work on Lord of the Rings, I started in 2000. It's now 7 years.
Mm.
Well,
that's a journey,
right there.
Tell me about the symphony performances for your Lord of the Rings score that have been taking place.
The symphony is a 6-movement piece for symphony orchestra, for mixed choir, adult choir, children's choir, soloists, and there's some folk instruments as well in it. It's the total instrumentation is 225 on stage, and it's a 2-hour and 10-minute piece. It's a narrative work that takes you through the world of Middle Earth, through Lord of the Rings, in that amount of time, really. It's not everything that was created, but it's really what was able to be played in a concert performance in one sitting.
Oh.
It's had, I think, about 140 performances all over the world, in the Far East and in Europe and Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Canada. And I've done many performances. I did a lot in 2004. This year I did one at the Blossom Festival with the Cleveland Orchestra, which is a great, amazing orchestra that I love. And that's the second time I performed with them of the symphony. And now I'm getting ready for a performance in Paris in at the Châtelet Theater in November 2nd and 3rd.
Oh.
And there's other conductors that play the work. So, you know, the symphony was really a way to give the work life. So it just didn't have these recordings, or it just didn't exist in the film.
Right.
It now can be played, and with real orchestras playing it, and and singers and children's choir, and it's a very community type event. I mean, you mentioned the Cincinnati orchestra is playing it this coming weekend, mm-hmm. and if you're in Cincinnati this week, you'll see like the choirs are rehearsing for it, the children are learning Tolkien's music, all in Cincinnati. All that comes is a conductor to do it, and it's all done with the Cincinnati community. And so it's really a wonderful kind of music making event, and it's great for in the community, and it really seems to have a great community type of feeling to it.
How satisfying must that be, that on a global level that your score is means so much to so many people. It's moving people so much.
Mm.
That's just an amazing, amazing accomplishment, The Lord of the Rings. We actually have an email question for you,
okay.
And it's concerning one of my all-time favorite scores, which is from The Fly.
Yes.
It's a very heightened and operatic score, so it makes sense that you're in the process of basing an opera around that concept. How is that shaping up?
The opera is finished compositionally. Piano vocal score was finished in the spring, and I'm orchestrating the piece now, and I'm going to Paris. The premiere is in Paris at the Châtelet in June 30th, this coming year, 2008, and it's a co-commission between Châtelet and Los Angeles Opera. It goes to Los Angeles in September.
Hmm.
And The Fly was something that I had thought about for many years. I thought it was a good opera subject. I became interested in opera in the early 80s, and I started thinking of film music in that way. I learned a lot about writing film music from studying opera, but I stayed away from it for a long time until I felt I was ready. And then after writing this much music for Lord of the Rings, which is essentially an opera work. It uses Tolkien's languages. His five languages are used in the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And the music for the film is essentially, it's based around voices, choral music, and soloists. And there's many singers that I wrote for in the course of that 10 or 11 hours of music. And so having done that, I felt, maybe I was ready for the opera, and I wanted to work with something that I was comfortable with, that I knew, and so I always thought The Fly was a good subject,
mm-hmm.
and I met Placido, and I told him about it. He became interested in it, and he commissioned it for L.A., and so I've been working on it for 2 years, and this is my last year now of orchestration and the rehearsals. I'm doing a workshop with David Cronenberg in Paris next week.
So he is, Mr. Cronenberg is involved?
Yes, in directing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes,
great,
yes.
Great.
Dante Ferretti did the production design, designer.
Incredible.
David Henry Wong wrote a wonderful libretto, incredible libretto, and it's cast now, and for me, it's just such a wonderful thing to work on. I mean, I love it. I love the form so much.
Yeah,
and it's just a great, great gift for me as a composer to work on it.
Well, I can't let you go without asking about two of my favorite talents that you've worked with. And one is Martin Scorsese. For the past few years, fairly regularly, you've with The Aviator and The Departed and some of his future projects, you've collaborated with him. What is it seems like if there is any director out there that is a musical director, he is definitely one.
Yes.
What's that like, that collaboration like?
Well, Marty loves music, as we know, and that's always been a great bond between us because we both love it so much.
Right.
So, and we're constantly passing ideas back and forth to each other. So that's really been a great part of the working together. And I met Marty and Selma Schoonmaker in the Brill Building in 1986.
Wow.
And I did a film with them called After Hours.
Yes.
And then I've worked with them on five productions now, I think. And they're just incredible to work with, Marty and Selma. And they're just great, great filmmakers. They're brilliant people to work with. They're funny and creative, and they challenge you, and you grow, and we try things, and it's just a very fluid, wonderful relationship and collaboration. And you see that in the films, I think. And Marty's like that with everybody who's working with in films, because there's so much love for the art of making films, and we all, you know, appreciate that. And so it's a nice place to work when you're working with Marty.
No, I bet it is. And his next project is the Rolling Stones concert film, The Shine a Light.
Yes.
What a perfect
such a great documentary filmmaker. I mean, the Dylan documentary was just breathtaking.
Oh, I love that documentary.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I also have to ask about the last person I need to ask you about, because I'm kind of a super geeky fan of this man's work, and that's Al Pacino. You worked with him
that's
on Looking for Richard.
Yes.
That was a big passion project of his. What was that? What was that experience like?
Well, it was actually a wonderful project, because I love working with writers, and you know, I've done other literary adaptions besides Tolkien, G.G. Ballard's Crash, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, and now Shakespeare. How wonderful to work with Shakespeare. And that just opened up, you know, a lot of creative ideas. The text for the score that I wrote is a Latin text. It was written by Elizabeth Cotnoir for the film. And I worked with a choir. It was recorded in a church. Al came. It was just it's just such a lovely thing when the director and the composer are interested in the same word, the writer.
Yeah.
You know, because you're really going back to the source. Like, both of us are looking at Richard and, you know, and really expressing ideas about Richard. And that's, you know, Looking for Richard is about Al Pacino's, you know, search for the truth in Richard III. And as the composer, you're doing the same thing. So you're really on the same wavelength, the same journey, and you know, and I think the work was good on that, very good.
It was fantastic. Any stories I can get about Pacino, I grab them wherever I can.
Yeah.
Mr. Shore, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yes, really, terrific. Thank you.
You are more than welcome to join us anytime in the future. Just say the word, but thank you so much.
Yeah, I look forward to that. That'd be good.